I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Antonio Rangel. He's a professor of economics at California Institute of Technology and has just published a paper in the journal Science, along with a number of his colleagues, titled Using Neural Measures of Economic Value to Solve the Public Goods Free Rider Problem. Welcome, Dr. Rangel.
Thank you.
So we want to talk in general about the neuroeconomics field that you're in. You run a neuroeconomics group at California Institute of Technology. So I want to ask you a couple questions after we talk about this very fascinating study you just did about neuroeconomics in general. But let's talk about the free rider problem first. What is the free rider problem?
Well, the free rider problem is a classical problem in economics and political science, and it has to do with the following problem. When a group of people have to decide whether or not to buy a good that benefits all of them, they have to agree on how to share the costs. Normally, you would like to have a fair arrangement in which, you know, the more you like the good, the more you pay, similar to when you go to a restaurant, the more you drink, the more you pay in the bill. Split the bill at the end. The problem is that if everybody knows this, they have an incentive to understate how much they're good, to lie in some sense, so they don't have to pay as much, because how much they end up consuming of the goods is dependent on how much they pay.
So this is a notion of justice implicit in the free rider problem, which is that everyone should pay according to their how much they really want something, instead of equally.
Yes. Yes, to be fair, there are solutions out there to the free rider problem in which you can guarantee optimal provision for a group of the public good. And by optimal, I mean that the good is only provided when the benefit to the group is larger than the cost. But the problem is an ideal solution should have this efficiency property, but also some sort of fairness of the sort I was describing.
So in the case of health insurance, we have this notion of justice being served when we have equal premiums as opposed to, you know, the actual value of a person's health being valued at the premium level. So this concept of the free rider problem is not the same in all different policy domains, right? In some domains.
What you're saying is absolutely correct. There is a distinction in public policy programs between what economists call public goods, which are goods that once they are purchased, they benefit everybody in the group. They are not excludable. And all other public policy programs, which represent public consumption of private goods, in the sense that I can give consumption to one individual without giving it to another. And health insurance is an example of the latter.
Okay, so you're concerned about the fact that people might not disclose the actual value of things to them, and so in a public debate, they might then under-sacrifice for the public good, this public good that's going to be gained. And mm-hmm. and so you came up with a potential solution for that in this paper. Can you describe mm-hmm. what the possible solution here is?
Well, the idea is... I need to give you a little bit of background for this to make sense, so it doesn't sound completely like insider's baseball, and it makes sense to your audience. The typical solution that economists have proposed for these public goods free rider problems, the best type of solutions, involve everybody in the group announcing how much they like the public good, and then based on that announcement, the groups decide whether or not to buy the public good, whether or not to buy national defense or the space station or something like that, and how to split the cost among the members of the group, okay? Now, the problem with those solutions is that they cannot fully achieve these two objectives that I was telling you before, which are intuitively these notions of fairness and these notions of efficiency. What we have done is combine the best of economic theory with new technologies from neuroscience to construct a procedure for a group in which they still announce whether or not they like the public good and how much, but we also read their brains using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, and then how much they pay depends not only on what they announce, but also on what the brain data is telling us their value is. We basically try to read their values with the fMRI data. And the intuition is that what we're trying to accomplish is very simple. If we think that you're lying to us, to the group, we charge you a premium. And that gives you an incentive to actually reveal the true value. It's some sort of lie detector applied to the public good.
Now, the fMRI research on truth-telling and lying is what you're building off of. How robust is that evidence that we can detect lying in the brain?
In my personal view, and it's not an area in which I have deep expertise, I would say I have superficial expertise. There has not been conclusive evidence that you can read brains. You can use fMRI as a high-quality lie detector. There has been some promising results, but the problem is that they have not been tested in really hard-case scenarios where people have an incentive to lie. So in some sense, we view our work very indirectly also as a contribution to that, because we basically construct an experiment in which people make money depending on their ability to lie to us in some sense. And we show that the technology works even when they have an incentive to lie.
So, and how did you show that it works? Well, what's the demonstration in your experiment that it works to detect lying?
What we did is we brought a group of subjects to our laboratory, and we constructed a simulated society in which individuals, the group, could decide whether or not to spend some money to buy a good that generated benefits for everyone. And if the good was produced, everybody benefited from it, regardless of whether or not they paid. And what we show is that we compare the best possible arrangement that the group could use without these neural technologies with the best possible arrangement that they could use introducing this neural technology, fMRI. And we show that we move from a circumstance in which inefficiencies for the group were very, very large, in the sense that the public good was not produced in many circumstances when it was valuable to the group, to one in which there was 100% efficiency. Essentially, basically, the group produced the public good if and only if it was efficient, and basically people did not lie. Nobody lied. Everybody revealed the true type, the true value for the public good.
Would the result have been the same if you were able to just convince them that you were going to be able to read their truth-telling, even if you weren't? So in other words,
go ahead.
If we could compel truth-telling simply by the threat that we might be able to read people's minds, we wouldn't necessarily have to read their minds.
Your comment is extremely insightful, and it's true with two caveats. First is, yes, if people were convinced that you could read their minds, and that you can penalize them if they lie, that would be enough to set them an incentive to tell the truth, which is the basic intuition of what we have done. The problem is the following, is that for this technology, we see this as proof of concept of a potential technology that will come online in the future with practical users. For this to be really feasible and sustainable, people need to know that you are not lying, that you can actually read their minds, not perfectly, but somewhat, with informative value. And if you cannot do that, the value of the technology will disappear, because people eventually will figure out that that is not the case. The second thing that is very important is that it's a question that is often asked about this application, is that it's not necessary that you read the mind of everybody in the group. If you had something that you could call probabilistic monitoring or auditing, much like the IRS does, in which with some probability your mind will be read, that will be sufficient also to give you the incentives to tell the truth.
So this is something that you speculate about at the end of the paper, which is the notion that we might, with some future application of this technology, be able to take random samples of brain images and determine the social utility of different public policy choices and how much they would benefit the public.
Correct.
The particular application here is one of truth-telling. So we're trying to get people to tell us truly how much something is of value. But another application, it seems, from potential future neurotechnology, brain imaging, might be the actual discernment of utility. In other words, I know that some fMRI research is trying to get at the lighting up of pleasure centers in the brain and the relative amount of pleasure or pain or distress that different kinds of choices cause for people. So we might not only be able to tell truth-telling, but also actual social utility that's created by different choices.
The question that you raised is a very deep one and a very hard one. And if you allow me, I want to make a few clarifications about this, because there is a lot of misunderstanding on the press about what neuroeconomics and behavioral neuroscience has accomplished so far and not, or has not. First point is, what we do in the paper that we were discussing before, in the paper that just came out in Science, is just not measure well-being in a comprehensive sense, but just try to measure whether people have high values or low values for these things. So in some sense, in terms of willingness to pay on the dollar value that they assign to these public goods, that's a relatively easy problem. A slightly harder problem is try to understand at any particular moment in time, if I give you, let's say, something we have played with in my laboratory, three different wines that generate three different levels of hedonic pleasure, can I, by reading your brain, tell whether you're having low or high hedonic pleasure? We haven't, I would say, cracked the problem 100% of our ability of just looking at the brain data, being able to tell how much pleasure you're having. But there has been a lot of progress made in that direction. I have no doubt that that question is going to be cracked in the next few years completely. Now, the question that is much, much harder, and I even conceptually it's not obvious how to think about it, is, can I use an fMRI scanner and get a comprehensive measure of your social, of your, what you were calling utility, your well-being, from different situations, from different government programs, from your current state of life? That is a very hard question. I'm hopeful that all the work that has been done in neuroeconomics will inform this problem, but it's not easy. It's the hardest problem of the three.
Well, it's interesting because the behavioral economics literature, Kahneman and people like that, they seem to be completely deconstructing the notion of rational choice, of a rational choosers, rational voting. You know, it just seems that the closer we examine all of the choices that we make, none of them appear to be rational. None of them appear to make us happy in the ways that we imagine that they would. So,
correct.
It seems that a lot of public policy is driven by a notion of utilitarian utility maximization. But if we, for instance, have happiness set points, if we have all these cognitive mechanisms for rationalizing ourselves back into a state of happiness, does it make any difference at all whether we have or produce utility or not?
I'm very sympathetic to the point that you're raising, and it's a big motivation for me for the research that we do. I think the evidence is unsurmountable at this point that the rational actor model of traditional economics is not able to explain a vast majority of decision-making by individuals. It's also the case that it's a notion that Danny Kahneman, the Nobel Prize winner, introduced for the first time in the literature, that one has to make a distinction between notions of value that are computed at the time of decision-making. So, for example, if I go to a store and I decide, do I buy this fancy car? What's the value that I anticipate that it's going to give me? That's a value that is computed at the time of choice, which is different from the actual value, the actual pleasure that it derives, you know, years later when I'm driving the car. And the evidence is strong that we are not very good at the time of choice as forecasting well the value at the time of consumption. So,
one of these sources
that,
of
that, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, one of these sources of irrationality that you've pointed to in your own research is the money illusion. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the money illusion is.
Yes, the idea of the money illusion is, I hope I can explain it simply and succinctly, is according to economic theory, the value of a dollar has to be measured in what economists call real terms, which simply means in its purchasing power, how many actual goods and services can it buy? So, for example, if you were to double all of the prices in the economy, but also double your income, you would be exactly equally well off because you could afford exactly the same things as before. That's according to standard economic theory. a lot of behavioral evidence, and we have a paper that shows that the brain is reacting in some, to some extent like that to monetary prices, suggests that people react to money, at least in the short term, in what economists call nominal terms, basically by how much currency do you have, and not exactly by how much money, how many goods and services actually can buy. So, for example, if I were to double again all of the prices in the economy, but also all of your income, you will feel that you're better off because you suddenly have more income. You don't see somehow through the effect that this has on purchasing power all the way.
The effect of free offers, for instance, that people are overwhelmed by the notion of getting something for free, even when they don't take into account all the other costs that go along with it.
There is very interesting work by a behavioral economist called Dan Ariely at Duke, who has shown that there is a discontinuity at the price of zero. Zero somehow is a special. Free is a special for people in a way that that is, again, not predicted by economic theory.
Now, this is also applied to public choice in the sense of candidate elections. You've done some research on candidate appearance as an influence on the way that people choose. For instance, there's a lot of research on height, isn't there, about the effect of the height of a candidate on public choice?
Yes. Let me tell you to me what is the most striking finding of this, which actually doesn't come from my own group, but from the group of Alex Todorov at Princeton. This is a study in a nutshell. It's just very striking. They bring subjects to the lab. They show them pairs of images of candidates that are true mugshots of politicians, but of not familiar famous politicians, you know, people who run in congressional elections in states other than your own. And they ask them to make a choice. Who would you vote for? Just based on a 1 second exposure to the pictures. Those decisions by those subjects based on a unfamiliar with the policies, can't predict party, but 1 second exposure to the mugshots correlates very highly with actual electoral outcomes after hundreds of millions of electoral expenditures. It's just mind-boggling.
So the spending by lobbyists and all the different ads and everything doesn't influence as much as we think. It's actually, in fact, it may be driven by the candidate's electability that they attract money or not, is what you're saying.
That is an interesting point. I don't want to make the strongest form of a statement that you're suggesting. I assume that if these people repeatedly spend so much money, they must get something out of it, or they believe that they get something out of it. But I'm also saying that there are forces at work that are incredibly unconscious, extremely fast-working, and pervasive, but have a very, very sizable effect on elections.
Well, John Edwards got criticized for having that $400 haircut. Maybe a $400 haircut makes a lot of sense for a candidate if your haircut's going to have such an influence.
Yes, if the press had not gotten the hand on it, yes.
Now, the particular technology that you're exploiting in this studies and some of these other studies you've done is the fMRI, which requires people to get into a big machine. And it's very difficult for me to imagine how you do some of this research because these are huge magnets, aren't they? And you have to be very careful about what you bring into the vicinity of the machine. And so it's very difficult to do the research in the first place. But do you, looking down the road, and I know you're not an expert on brain imaging, but do you foresee the portability and the miniaturization of these kinds of technologies so that they could, in fact, become more widespread research tools?
A helmet that people could wear on the field that would allow us to get a high-resolution neural correlates of brain activity will be a dream. Unfortunately, as far as I know, there is nothing on development that right now that would look like that in the short term. So, but you know, science has advanced and technology in neuroscience has advanced dramatically over the last two decades. One can always dream, but I do not know of anything on development right now that has those features.
I know that there's this Emotive company that's coming out with an EEG reader, but that's very crude in comparison to what the fMRI is doing, which is reading actual structural lighting
in
the brain.
First of all, they measure very different signals in the brain. Both of them are correlated with brain activity, but they have very different properties and they have very different origins. And also, for example, these helmets that are being sold for video games and things like that are basing their responses, even though they are amazing pieces of equipment, don't get me wrong, but they are basing the responses off what I would call very general properties of brain activity, very strong responses in the brain, whereas the signals and the brain response that we look for are much more subtle. So it's not that easy. Maybe. I just we are playing with a lot of things, but it's a very hard problem.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's fascinating research. We've been talking with Dr. Antonio Rangel. He's the co-author of an article called Using Neural Measures of Economic Value to Solve the Public Goods Free Rider Problem. And if you have more questions, can people contact you at California Institute of Technology?
Sure. My email is on the web.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This semester, I'm teaching a class on happiness again. I taught one last year, and it was a popular success, and so students asked me to teach it again this fall. One of the topics that we discuss in the course is the country of Bhutan, where the king announced back in 1972 that the happiness of his people was going to be the guiding force or the guiding goal of public policy as opposed to gross national product. So he had announced that gross national happiness was going to be the Bhutanese alternative. And the independent magazine, independent newspaper in England has just published a very interesting story called How the Happy Kingdom in the Clouds Lost Its Smile by Andrew Buncombe. And I want to read a little bit of this essay because it shows some of the problems with a utilitarian happiness-oriented policy, which has been applauded by many Greens and people who advocate on behalf of alternative sustainable development models that they think Bhutan might have represented. But I think the case in Bhutan represents some of the difficulties with a low-tech or sustainable or greenish approach to public happiness or public policy success. So at any rate, How the Happy Kingdom in the Clouds Lost Its Smile by Andrew Buncombe. For the emergency department of Bhutan's largest hospital, last Tuesday was a pressing day. In the space of a few hours, six people were rushed in, all suspected of having tried to commit suicide. One of the patients, a 35-year-old housewife, said she had taken 30 sedatives after problems at home. The second, a woman of 27, had swallowed 15 paracetamol tablets after quarreling with her husband. The third to require urgent treatment was a 17-year-old girl who was rushed in unconscious, having drunk nail polish or remover after an argument with her sister. The other three cases were prisoners from the local jail who had emptied a bottle of mysterious spirit. Some reports claimed that they had tried to take their lives, but officials are unsure. By the standards of a hospital in a large city in the West, the numbers might be unremarkable, but the Jigme Dorji Dwangchuk National Referral Hospital is in Thimphu, the capital of the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan, which has a total population of less than 700,000. What's more, this enigmatic mountain kingdom is feted around the world for its gross national happiness, a national policy in which the emotional well-being of its citizens is considered more important than their financial bottom line. Yet evidence suggests that all is not so happy-clappy in this high-altitude Buddhist kingdom. Suicide appears to be becoming common as Bhutan's population, for centuries cut off from the outside world, struggles to deal with the pace of change. News reports detail how growing numbers are taking their lives, usually by poison or hanging. A Bhutanese newspaper claimed, in some villages, committing suicide has almost become a norm. Jigme Tinley, the country's first democratically elected prime minister, recently identified the surge towards modernity, breaking traditional family and community bonds, as pushing people to take their lives. I don't think the country is opening too quickly, but change is happening and disorientation is taking place, Mr. Tinley said last week in Tokyo, where he was meeting business leaders to discuss gross national happiness. Bhutan isn't a happy place. There are many reasons for people to be unhappy, ranging from the physical to the material. Bhutan, squeezed between China and India, has always been a place apart. Until recently, the remote country turned its back on the outside world. Tourism has been restricted, and after the seizure of Tibet by China and the absorption of Sikkim by India, Bhutan was the last of a trio of once independent Buddhist Himalayan kingdoms. Television only arrived in 1999, and it was not until last year that Bhutan held its first general election. Until then, the country had been an absolute monarchy, and critics, including a number of Bhutanese in exile, claimed that even that election was not as open as may have appeared. However slow change may have been to arrive, the pace of transformation has been fast. In 2006, the much-loved king Jigme Singye Wangchuck announced plans to abdicate. And last year, the two-year delay having been explained by the insistence of royal astrologers to await an appropriate date, his young Oxford-educated son, Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuck, was crowned. During the dramatic ceremony at the Tashicho Dzong Palace in Thimphu, the father, who had personally developed the idea of gross national happiness, placed a black silk raven crown on his son's head, marking the switch from one generation to the other. Reports suggest that many Bhutanese were initially bewildered by the old king's decision both to step down and to turn the country into a democracy, yet other changes have been far more harmful. Rapid urbanization has seen many traditional networks break down, while unemployment and drug abuse has risen. It is against this backdrop that the increased number of suicides has been placed. Statistics are hard to obtain. One report suggested that there were as many as 58 suicides in 2001, with fewer than 20 so far this year. Yet officials appear convinced that in reality, numbers are on the rise. The clues suggesting that more people may be taking their lives have been around for several years. Last year, the Center for Bhutan Studies in Thimphu carried out several surveys as a part of its work in researching the nine pillars, among them health, education, governance, and psychological well-being, that are used to measure gross national happiness. Researchers said that they were shocked to find that almost 5% of respondents said they thought of committing suicide, while 1.4% had actually attempted to take their own lives. Michael Rutland, chairman of the Bhutan Society of the UK, is a regular visitor to the country. He said he believed the most harmful change for Bhutan was the increasing number of people moving into towns and cities. In this regard, the biggest change has been urbanization. It leads to a breakdown in the local communities and also means that when a young person goes into the cities, they lose a large amount of their support structures. This is particularly true with something like childcare, where in the rural areas, everyone helps look after children. Of course, this is not something unique to Bhutan, but the difference is that in Bhutan, this has only been happening for the last 20 years. Despite the official stress on happiness, around a quarter of Bhutan's population live below the poverty line, and education and healthcare remain limited, especially outside the cities. Doctors say they are now waking up to the psychological problems that exist in Bhutan. DK Nirola is a psychiatrist at a hospital in Thimphu, where many of the cases were taken. Before, we had a more rural setting where we had a very good support structure from our friends and relatives, and that seems to be going away, especially as people take more care of material gain. It's a contradiction when you want to promote gross national happiness, but people want to be more consumerist. We still haven't met the basic conditions needed for the pursuit of happiness, said the U.S. educator Mr. Tinley. The positive thing is that the media is giving cause for alarm, and the government is alarmed. So that was How the Happy Kingdom in the Clouds Lost Its Smile by Andrew Buncombe of The Independent in the UK, and a sobering reflection on the possibility of achieving a goal of gross national happiness in the context of rapid modernization. And I think what applies to Bhutan applies to the entire world, because the pace of change is accelerating, and we're all having to adapt to conditions of modernity that we're not quite very well adapted to yet. So do your best to stay happy and check back next week for more Change Surfer Radio. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.